Welcome to What You Didn't Expect in Fertility, Pregnancy, and Birth. How we think and feel about this enormous transition often lives in the gap between what we expected and what we actually experienced. This gap exists in part because of how we tend to talk about and portray these events on all kinds of media in a one-dimensional way. Everything was amazing. But it's more often the case that there are beautiful things that happen and, at the same time, really challenging things that happen. This show shares true experiences, both the easy parts and the difficult parts, and how we manage what we didn't expect. The intense things that can happen in the course of this transition can impact how you see yourself, how you see your partner, and how you parent. The better we understand what happened to us, the better we can manage all the things that follow. I'm your host, Paulette Kamenica. I'm a writer and an economist and the mother of two girls. And I met many, many challenges in this process, none of which I expected. This week's episode features the story of a woman who had two nearly opposite experiences of birth. Like many of us, the first one was rough, including anything but gentle treatment at the hospital and an unpleasant C-section. The second one was a vast improvement, which started her on a journey to learn more about birth and to become what she needed that first time around, an excellent doula. What follows is the first part of our conversation. Hi, thanks so much for coming on the show. Can you introduce yourself and tell us where you're from?
Hi, my name is Susie Beers. I am a doula in Seattle, Washington.
Cool, excellent. And Susie, how long have you been a doula for?
Let's see, I started about 4.5 years ago. I've done about 200 births and it has been a wild journey.
Wow, I bet. And do you have kids of your own?
Yep, I do. They are 9 and 5, so they are growing, but they came into the world in very different ways and kind of sparked my journey into this career.
Okay, perfect. This is exactly what we're going to talk about. I'm so excited. So before you got pregnant, did you know that you wanted a family? Do you have siblings? Did you grow up thinking, I want to have a family and recreate this? Or what was your path to that idea?
Yeah, I came from a very conservative family where I was taught my whole life, my role was to be a mother, to be a stay-at-home mother, and that if I had a career, it would be harmful to my children. So I feel like I maybe had very complex emotions around wanting children, where in some ways I desperately wanted children. In other ways, I feel like I was also very rushed. I got married very young and I started my journey, I think, before I was really ready. So yes, I did want children, but I think I maybe had them sooner than I was ready for.
So what I'm guessing is you grew up in the culture that tells you that you should be working. A little bit in conflict with the family message.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess I grew up kind of in a conflict of the family because my mom was very conservative, but I grew up going to bring your daughter to work day and my dad worked in finance and those were some of my best memories. So I was always very career driven and I always had a conflict. So when I was in college, I had a strong, like, don't graduate without your MRS. And that was always the priority. And then it was always like, yeah, go ahead and work until you have kids. But when you have kids, choose to be a stay-at-home mother or else your children are going to suffer. And then go back when you're done if you want to. So yeah, I don't know. I've always loved having a career. It's part of who I am. My time as a stay-at-home mother was kind of difficult for me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll get into that. I can relate to all of this story already. So when you're walking into pregnancy, do you get pregnant easily?
Yes. Yes, I do. I got married when I was 22. We decided to get pregnant, try for a baby when I was 24. So it was an intentional choice. Our first pregnancy, though, we actually had a molar pregnancy. So I don't know if you've ever heard of what that is. Basically, there's a problem with the placenta. It's kind of growing like a tumor instead of like a placenta. And if it goes unnoticed, those tumor cells are cancerous and it can spread. So that was really chaotic too, because I was super, super sick. And it was really hard to get seen by a care provider that would acknowledge like, yeah, your level of sickness is beyond what's normal. So when we finally went in at 14 weeks and we did an ultrasound, there was no heartbeat. And then they did a DNC very quickly after. So that was, you know, maybe the first time that I had ever done anything medical, and it was very scary and very sad. And I had wanted this child at that time and, you know, was devastated. And then on top of that, coming out of it, having about a year of having to do blood tests and watch my HCG, I remember my doctor calling me and saying, "Susie, something was weird with your DNC. I need you to come back to the office." And I got there and he handed me a pregnancy test and was like, "Go pee on a stick." And I was like, "You literally just ripped this baby I wanted out of me, and now you want me to take a pregnancy test and it's positive? How is that possible?"
What's a molar pregnancy? Molar pregnancy happens when there's a genetic error with fertilization. A sperm can fertilize an egg with no chromosomes, and then a version of a placenta is formed that produces HCG but no fetus. Or there can be a partial molar pregnancy, where two sperm fertilize the same egg. Now there's a version of a placenta and a fetus with too many chromosomes, which can't survive. One of the symptoms of this is severe nausea and vomiting, which it sounds like Susie experienced. And then this condition is managed with a DNC. And what can happen, and did in Susie's case, is that despite the DNC, there can be some placental tissue that remains and continues to secrete HCG, which explains the positive pregnancy test after the DNC.
And so it was a long time before I was able to attempt pregnancy again, before I was back to having no HCG in my blood and feeling confident that I was in a place that was healthy enough to try again. But then when we did try again, we got pregnant right away with Zoe. And same with Hazel. We got pregnant quickly. So we did kind of have like a mix there.
Good Lord, that's a lot. For someone who isn't necessarily ready to be thrust into that experience, seems like a ton to handle. I'm sorry about how hard that sounds. And then when you got pregnant with your first, is that because you were trying to?
Yeah. Okay. We definitely were trying to. I was working in finance at an investment bank at the time, and it felt like the right time. We were in a culture and in a place where it was like, you're married, you've been married for a couple of years now. What are you doing?
We purposely
tried to have both all of our kids. So
sought it out. Okay. So what did you think pregnancy would be like before you were pregnant? Or did that the first experience with the molar pregnancy color what you thought it would be?
The first time I was pregnant with the molar pregnancy, I was so sick. I literally couldn't eat anything and I was losing weight like crazy. And I'm a pretty small person to begin with, just naturally one of those people that can be skinny fat, you know, eat really bad, but still, you know, I'm tall. And so I was really concerned about losing weight. And even I was working 50 hours a week and I'm placing trades and doing things with people's money. And so being one decimal point off, and that was incredibly stressful because it's really, really hard to focus and hard to do a good job and be detailed at anything when you're feeling sick at that level and you're malnourished at that level too. I mean, I think if I could eat 3 bites of Lucky Charms in those days, I was like, okay, this is a good day food wise. Other than that, I was just losing weight so fast and it was so scary. So when I got pregnant with Zoe, I had a lot of fear and I was very, very emotional because I was so excited to be pregnant. Also didn't have the courage to believe that this was real. Also had been, you know, when you've experienced something that's like, I think molar pregnancies are like 1 in 1,000, you know? And so then when you're hearing odds of everything else, you're like, well, shoot, that could happen to me, you know? The probabilities and odds, all of a sudden you see yourself in every negative situation. So I did have a lot of fear to work through, but I was also really, really happy. I mean, I wanted her. I had been on this very emotional roller coaster of a journey. And so there was peace in the, like, it's finally happening for me.
Good. And I'm imagining you were much less sick the second time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a little bit of nausea, but when you've been through sickness at the extreme, I didn't even care about it.
Good.
So
okay, good.
I was, yeah. Okay.
That seems like confirmatory nausea.
Yeah,
yes, we're still pregnant. This is great. And it's not knocking you out.
Yeah. And it felt kind of fun to have the rite of passage of, oh, I get to go through all the pregnancy things because For, you know, I didn't expect pregnancy to be like, it wasn't until I had Hazel where I was like, okay, I want to try to embrace the pregnancy glow. I was okay with pregnancy being what it was, you know, and it all felt really happy to get to be there and get to be experiencing these things, even if they weren't super pleasant. So
that's a really good attitude. So I'm glad you're sharing that because your frame of mind affects how you feel pretty dramatically. And to recognize this is uncomfortable and this does not feel great, but I'm so lucky that I get to be pregnant and the pregnancy seems like it's going fine. So I'll take it. So what was the rest of the pregnancy like?
Wow. So it was almost 9 years. It was 9 years ago, almost 10 years ago. It's hard to remember. I was working a lot. The things that I remember most were I'd go for walks every day on my lunch. And I had a couple people on my team that their wives were pregnant. And so that was really fun. I think my children's dad and I are divorced. We didn't connect very well during that time. So we didn't do a lot of birth prep. I remember there was a lot of stress and a lot of fights around that kind of stuff. Like, we need to do a hospital tour. No, we should take, like, Trevor wants us to do this birth class with us. They hired someone to come teach them at their house. No. And so I think there were emotional battles that I was like, I had this weird ability of putting things that were not great on the shelf and ignoring them and living in my little, I had really embraced the concept of building a bubble of peace, which in some ways was really helpful. And I think in some ways allowed me to put off difficult conversations that I needed to be having and should have been having. But I very much did embody that bubble of peace and lived within it.
Well, it sounds like an adaptive strategy, right, for the time, right? There are only so many things you can take on. You are growing a human and have a full-time job. Mm-hmm. So when we're coming up to the birth, do you have an idea of how you want the birth to go?
Yeah. So the girl's dad's family is very naturally minded, and there was an expectation that I would do a natural birth. I came from a family that was opposite, and my original thinking was like, sign me up for an epidural. I really don't care if I have a C-section. But as I kind of learned, and I had also had like such mixed experiences because I had started care with the molar pregnancy with a midwife who was ignoring the fact that I was so sick. And then I had the OBs that were so caring. And even after the surgery, were checking up on me and making sure I was okay. And, you know, they were so good in that time of chaos, I guess.
Yeah.
So I did some hypnobirthing training. I watched The Business of Being Born. I really came around to the idea that there was reason to do a natural birth. And so I kind of set that as my goal. The part of the hypnobirthing training I did was, you know, I created my bubble of peace, which I think I kind of took out of context. But I didn't, you know, when I was like, oh, I should listen to these meditations at night, or I need to practice my stress release. You know, that kind of stuff was kind of scoffed at home. And so I didn't do it. And same with the nutrition things. I read about it, but I didn't really. There's a difference between learning and conceptually thinking about it and learning in a way that you can embody what you're learning. And I never was able to really address my fear of labor. You know, I learned about things, but that fear just stayed locked away in, I don't know. It was something that was just kind of ominously there that came out other times. And so when I went into labor, I was pretty scared.
I think that is a pretty common experience. I think that for sure, way before I got to labor, the idea that I would be in labor definitely freaked me out. And I was nervous about, I mean, it seemed scary, right? And one person that I spoke to, and this is kind of in line with what you were saying about appreciating that I get to be pregnant and do all this stuff. She was saying that she welcomed the pain of labor because that was something unique between her and the baby. It would not be recreated ever again. And they wouldn't have that connection ever again. And so whatever it brought was something that was unique and kind of beautiful in that light. Now, I don't know
that's beautiful.
It's so lovely to think of it in that way. I don't know whether when you feel like your body's being ripped apart, you can hold on to that beautiful notion.
Yeah.
But it might be a way to manage the fear while you're not feeling the pain.
Yeah.
Right? Or in the lead up or whatever. So take us to the day the baby is born. How do we know today's the day and how does that all unfold?
Yeah. So the Friday at work had been really fun. It was my last day of work and we had gone to the Boys and Girls Club and we did like, it was just like a community day with them. So we had been doing water fights and, you know, we did outdoor painting. So it was this really weird but fun day at work. And when I got home, I was exhausted, just ate some good food, took a long bath at night before I went to bed. And when I got out of the bath, there was a big pop and my water broke. My contractions didn't start right away. I called my doctor and he said, you can come in anytime, but if you want to sleep, go ahead and sleep, come in the morning. Or if you have contractions, he just gave me a list of like things to come in. So my plan had been to labor at home as long as possible. So I did stay home. I went to bed. Not much happened. In the night, my contractions started picking up. And by about 8 o'clock in the morning, they were at about that 5 minutes apart where you'd have a contraction and then walk a few steps and then you'd have a contraction. So that was great. I was excited about that. I was coping pretty well then. We get in the car, we drive to the hospital. We don't know where to park. It's kind of chaotic getting to the birth center because we'd never actually walked through the hospital. And I was angry about that because it was something I had wanted to do and was feeling like, you know, a really strong disconnect of feeling almost let down. Like, I asked you so many times to do this and now here we are and I'm in labor and I'm stressed and I'm feeling uncertain. And then we went to go check in and I got to the front desk where you're filling out all the paperwork. And the nurse says to me, your water broke last night. You could have killed your baby.
Wow.
Yeah. It was really intense and really inappropriate. And at that moment, I think that was the last contraction I had, was standing at that desk. By the time I was checked into my room, my contractions were gone.
Labor is often seen as this mechanistic process, the goal of which is to get the baby from inside the mother to outside the mother. And in some sense, that's true. But it's also true that it's a psychological transition, too. A bunch of articles have documented the fact that anxiety can stall a labor. The idea is that anxiety induces the release of catecholamines, or stress hormones, in the blood that shuts down contractions. This makes sense, quote-unquote, in the wild. An animal that felt threatened when it was going to give birth would shut down that process. So while the birthing person may be too focused on their body to have an impact on the environment around them, if you have a support person involved in your birth, to the best of their ability, if they can foster an environment of safety and calm, by, for example, asking that nurse to stand down, that might be helpful.
The rest of the day, you know, my doctors popped in and out. I was excited. The doctor that was on call was the doctor that I had worked with through the molar pregnancy. But it was weird because he didn't seem to remember me or remember, oh, hey, we have this history together. And all of our conversation was about, we have to get your labor started. Your water's been broken. You could get an infection. Your baby could be in trouble. And so I was very much like in this point of something is very wrong. I was very scared. Very overwhelmed, very much back in the emotions of when I went in for that first ultrasound with my first pregnancy and there just wasn't a heartbeat.
I'm going to stop right there for a second. This is so unfair. Why did the doctor on the phone tell you to go to bed?
Right, right. And honestly, when water breaks, there are different approaches to it. So, you know, I see that with my clients too. Some doctors will be like, whatever, come in when you're ready. And other doctors will be like, okay, we got to induce this labor and get this baby out of you if your contractions don't start. And I think there's validity to both points of view. But to have one practice giving me different points of view and not talking me through things in a way that was bringing me back to a place of recognizing that I'm not in immediate danger. My baby's not in immediate danger. We're talking about things that are happening potentially in the future, if there's a really long labor. And even then, there's tools that could protect us and there's antibiotics and there's surgery and things like that, you know, where we're truly not anywhere near a life-threatening situation.
So this is an interesting question. What is the infection risk once water breaks? According to ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, in a bulletin titled Approaches to Limit Intervention During Labor and Birth, the authors find that if there's no maternal or fetal reason to expedite birth, 12 to 24 hours is an appropriate window to watch and wait, or otherwise known as expectant management. The bulletin goes on to say, and I quote, "The optimal duration of expectant management that maximizes the chance of spontaneous labor while minimizing the risk of infection has not been determined."
The feeling that I had and some of the words that had been spoken to me made me feel very clearly, yeah, this was very scary. And then I had a friend that was
like
a doula.
The nurse was so hostile, right? Like the nurse was totally hostile when he got there, which is so not helpful. At this point, that decision has already been made. So why are we focused on that, right? The next step is make sure you don't have infection.
Yeah. Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. And I really wish I had called the hospital and said something about that, because it's completely inappropriate to say anything like that to a mom in labor. But, you know, it's my first time having a baby going through the labor process. And so it stuck with me. And then I had a friend that was a doula who I called, and she actually gave me terrible advice too.
I know.
And she said, you don't have to be in the hospital. You're stressed. Check yourself out. Go home. Get yourself back together. Take care of yourself for a couple hours and then go back. And so, but where I was with, you know, if you believe your baby's in danger, you're not going to get up and leave the hospital. So I don't know. I can see that being okay situation and okay advice if you knew your baby was okay, if you had just done an on stress test and your care team was on board with that plan. But, you know, you have to have the right communication to be able to do that. And I did not have the skills to have conversation like that at the time with my care provider. And they certainly were too busy and not paying enough attention to have that conversation with me either.
So they had just like accused you of staying home. So there's no way they're going to say, oh, you want to leave? Go ahead. Come back later. That doesn't work, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it could be, you know, the nurse has one point of view. The OB has another point of view. And this was a group practice. So the OB on call at night had one point of view, and the OB on call during the day has another point of view. And that happens a lot. But it was just like a series of very poor care. And from a team that I know can do better than that, because they did better than that for me the first time.
Yeah.
But yeah, so throughout the day, Pitocin got turned up. We tried to use Pitocin to get labor started. Again, labor was really painful once I had the Pitocin. I don't know. That was like the worst couple hours of my life. Got the epidural. Had a lot of big feelings about that too, because now like I had expectations on me to do this natural birth. And I had thought that I could do it. Didn't. And then, you know, when there had been no change, no progress, I was still not even 3 centimeters dilated. At midnight, they were like, okay, it's time for, it's been 24 hours since your water broke. Let's just do a surgical birth. So we had been having some heart rate dips, but I have no idea how, you know, with what I know now, I'm like, I have so many questions. I wish I could see that strip.
Yeah.
But I didn't have any context of how much of that is normal. You know, would that be a category 1 or a category 2, or were we pushing the line and really needed to get back there quickly? I still have a lot of mysteries around that experience.
Yeah. So 2 questions. Sorry. Do you have any idea whether the hospital you had that baby in has a high C-section rate or no?
Oh yeah, it's crazy high.
So one of the people that studies these things, he's at Harvard.
Neil Shah, right?
Yes. Exactly.
Thank it's you Neil Shah, and he talks about look up your C-section rates. Leapfrog. Well,
for sure. Leapfrog yes, group. Exactly right. Exactly right. So Neil Shah talks about that. But the other thing he talks about is hospitals are doing really well at what they've been set up to do. So your hospital was doing really well at managing C-sections, because that's what they're set up to do, which may not be what you want them to do or what they should be doing. But this is what it sounds like to me, right? Is they're pushing you through these steps. And I want to take 1 second to defend younger Susie, who should not be expected to do an anesthesia-free birth once the Pitocin is added to the mix.
I know. No, I would never go back and try that again.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I hear that said, like, because I attend a lot of births now, and I hear when the Pitocin question comes up, and sometimes Pitocin is a good choice and sometimes it is the right choice. But I often hear that, oh, labor is really hard. It brings everybody to their limit. So it's not going to be any different. And I would beg to differ. I did my second birth naturally. I did. Hazel was a 10-pound baby, gave birth to her naturally, and had a actually really great healing redemptive experience like that. I would have that birth, like I would give birth, go through that experience so many times. I would never go back to that Pitocin without an epidural situation. You couldn't pay me $1 million to live that again.
Yeah, so, there's a lot of scientific studies that quantify the difficulty with Pitocin. And that's not a unique experience to any one person. I think because Pitocin is oxytocin not related to what's going on in your system, it doesn't generate the same hormones and it feels totally different, right? It is a much it's more intense different. Birth because the contractions are so close together.
Yeah. And to me, they felt very sharp. They felt much more almost like stabby, when I had the just regular contractions, thinking about them like a wave and breathing through them were things that, okay, it was an intense experience. I'm not going to say it wasn't hard, but it was manageable.
Yeah.
And it felt positive and productive where I just was like, you know, just the only thing I can think of with the Pitocin was I'm in pain. Yeah. So I would say for me, there was a very big difference in the experience of what contractions felt like with and without the Pitocin. But everybody's different. I've seen people go through and induce labors and give birth naturally, and some people can do it. So
I totally agree that some people can do it, and sometimes Pitocin is absolutely the answer. I'm just saying in many cases, it creates a different intensity of contractions. And so when you're thinking about a natural birth, you're adding this unnatural element. And so you may have to recalibrate because now you're not in the same space you were before. Are we happily being wheeled to the C-section suite?
Oh my God. The C-section was terrible too. So the C-section goes pretty quickly, but it's late at night at this point, middle of the night. We've had this big lead up of she could be in danger. The moment I walked into the hospital, I felt like we were in danger and that at any time something could happen to her. So the C-section, I guess, technically goes pretty smoothly. They swaddle Zoe up. They hold her by my cheek for 5 minutes so I get to say hi to her. And then Zoe and her dad leave and they don't tell me where they're going or what's going on or if she's okay or if this is anything. They're sewing me up and they're talking about their vacations or something. And I'm feeling like I'm having this very intense reaction to some of the medication. I feel like there's an elephant on my chest. I'm not really sure if I'm really breathing or if I'm okay. I've never had dry mouth that badly where I feel like I'm literally in a desert and I'm about to die. You know, I'm shaking. My whole body is shaking in reaction to the medication. And nobody reassures me. Nobody says, oh, yeah, a lot of this is very normal. Breathe through it. Let me like help you focus your mind, help you find a sense of safety in this. And then after the surgery, they wheel me into the recovery room and they turn the light out. And they just leave me there for 3 hours.
I'm going to stop my conversation with Susie here for today. I appreciate her sharing these really challenging events with us. Unfortunately, a fair amount of what she experiences is something many of us can relate to. Because it's her first experience with pregnancy and birth, and she's trying to go with the flow and rely on the people around her, when it doesn't go well, she doesn't have a way to respond. Listening to her, I can't help but think, if only you had a doula with you, someone with much more experience of birth who could put things in context, like how common it is to have shakiness after birth. Next week, we'll hear the rest of Susie's story, how this first birth ended, how the second experience of pregnancy and birth went, and how she became the person she needed during this vulnerable transformation. Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, please share it with friends. We'll be back next week with the rest of Susie's inspiring story.